Со двора подъезд известный под названием «Черный ход». В том подъезде, как в поместье, проживает черный кот. Он в усы усмешку прячет, темнота ему как щит. Все коты поют и плачут.
Welcome to another edition of New Books in Russian Eurasian Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Sean Guillory. Every week we pick a new book on Russia or Eurasia and talk to the author. This week, we have a discussion with Thomas Duval about his book, The Caucasus, An Introduction. One word comes to mind when thinking about the South Caucasus, complex, knitted together in an area roughly the size of Montana, and sandwiched between the Black and Caspian Seas are three nations, Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan, three territorial disputes, Abkhazia, Nagorno-Karabakh, and South Ossetia, and numerous distinct ethnic groups, cultures, and languages. It's a lot to take into account, but one must to get a sense of the region. This is why I think Thomas Duval's book, The Caucasus, An Introduction, is so important. Duval does a good job making the region's complexity understandable, all the while placing it into larger geopolitical contexts. So without further delay, here's my interview with Thomas. Enjoy. Hi, Thomas.
Good morning.
Welcome to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. Thanks for taking the time to talk to us about your book, The Caucasus, An Introduction. Just to begin, why don't you tell us a bit about yourself and how you got interested in the region?
Absolutely. Well, I'm a Russianist by background. I have a Russian literature degree. Did Russian in the 1980s, and so sort of started going to Russia and Soviet Union properly just in the perestroika period. Then went back as a journalist in 1993 and was there for 4 years as a journalist in the 90s. And I suppose I was always drawn southwards. Some people, I guess, in Russia would be drawn to the east, to Siberia. I was always one of those people who was drawn to the south. Obviously, there was a lot of journalistic material there in terms of the conflicts of the both North and South Caucasus. But I always enjoyed the complexity of the Caucasus. It was the weather was always a bit better, the scenery was nicer, the people a bit more exotic, and somewhere I could speak Russian. And so I guess from the early 90s I've been involved in this region. And really compared to the Balkans, with which obviously there are many parallels, struck by how little it was covered, how its complexities were not really being written about in English. And so that was also quite exhilarating to be someone who was really often coming on kind of virgin territory. And the three books that I've done have all really been a response to what I think was a gap in the market when I wrote the book on Chechnya with Carlotta Gall in 1997. There wasn't one for the general reader in English on that war. Likewise, there wasn't really a balanced book on the Karabakh conflict in English. In that sense, I wrote the book that I wanted to read, explaining how that conflict started, and I think no one even since then has tried to write one. And likewise, talking to Oxford University Press, we decided that there wasn't a short book in English, a kind of primer for people to understand the Caucasus, and that was why I ended up writing this latest book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. I mean, it's such a complicated place, as you say in the introduction in the book. I think a primer is necessary, very clean, to the point, aimed to a general public, so it definitely achieves those goals. So let's begin talking about the book. You begin the book by mapping the geography of the Caucasus. How does geography shape the various historical, ethnic, and linguistic identities in the region?
Well, I think geography is incredibly important after all. And we're really talking about the South Caucasus. The book is a slight misnomer. It should really have been called the South Caucasus, but my publisher told me it wouldn't sell as many copies if it's called it that. Geography is incredibly important. So this is a region defined by mountains, and by three big natural barriers: the Caucasus Mountains, the Black Sea to the west, and the Caspian Sea to the east. So only really the southern and southwestern borders are the kind of political borders of this region. And I think because of the geography, you do have this concentration of small ethnic groups in a region, in a comparatively small region surrounded by much bigger neighbors. And I think that has shaped its historical destiny ever since. And I think the other important point to make is, well, I mean, just to continue that point, this makes for a region which is the kind of lands in between. It's no one's backyard and everyone's backyard. So these small peoples existing on the crossroads between Europe and Asia, North and South, Black and Caspian Seas, Christianity and Islam as well, who use their mountain geography, as it were, to maintain a precarious kind of independence and actually, I would argue in this book, manipulating the outside powers just as much as the outside powers manipulate them. That's the South Caucasus. And I think another important point to make is the strong difference between the South and North Caucasus, the South Caucasus being a kind of international arena in which Russia has been a dominant player, but not the only player for the last 200 years, and in which even in the Soviet period, Russia very much ruled by consent and co-option. This wasn't a full Russian colonial region. The North Caucasus obviously being different, a natural extension of Russia's geographic space, smaller peoples with much weaker institutions. So a very different history there.
Yeah, I should clarify that we are talking about the South Caucasus, primarily Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan. Religion, I think, is one of the interesting things too, is because the Caucasus represents one of the few places in the world where you have a conglomeration of Christians, Jews, and Muslims, both Shia and Sunni. What role has religion played in the social and political contours of the region?
Well, obviously, it's very important, and religion defines the national identity of the two old Christian nations, Georgians and Armenians, compared to the Muslim Azerbaijanis, and then obviously other smaller national groups are either Christian or Muslim as well. But I wouldn't say, and I think this is a very important kind of identity marker in this region, and very important to its culture. I wouldn't, however, say that it's been an important driver in the conflicts or in the kind of international relations of the region. Look at this comparatively good relationship between Christian Georgia and Muslim Azerbaijan, as opposed to the enmity between Christian Armenia and Muslim Azerbaijan. That's one paradox there. And also the fact that actually Christian Armenia has a much better relationship with the Islamic Republic of Iran than Azerbaijan does. So I think that tells us that on an everyday level, of course, religion is important, but it's not a driver in its international relations.
And has it was it an important drive in the past?
Well, again, yes and no. I think it probably was an important it was important, and yet well, the closer you look into Caucasian history, the more paradoxes it throws up. The fact that, for example, and this is kind of buried by Georgian historians, Georgia spent a couple of 100 years being a province of the Persian Empire, in which its monarchy and aristocracy all converted to Islam. That's, I think, one interesting historical nugget we shouldn't forget. Also, I think the Sunni Shia divide used to be, I think, quite important, more important than Turkic solidarity. We find Shia Azeris fighting along with the Russian army against Sunni Turks in the 19th century. The famous Karabakh regiment of horsemen in the Russian Empire was actually Azeri Shias, who actually fought, actually not only fought the Turks, but sometimes even in the North Caucasus as well. So this is a region where I think the identities that look rather durable actually fairly modern constructions in any way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we'll get to that modern construction of nationalism in the region, certainly. Throughout much of its history, and you've alluded to this already, that there's various relationships, and when on the surface one might think even contradictory relationships between peoples of the region and the great powers that surround them. And throughout much of its history, the Caucasus has been sandwiched between three great powers, Persia, Russia, and the Ottomans. How did these external powers influence the shaping of the region?
Well, obviously, enormously. Up until about 1800, Iran/Persia and the Ottoman Turks being the two big colonial powers, a big east-west division in the Caucasus, with the eastern part, Azerbaijan, and eastern half of Georgia being, and Armenia as well, being in the Persian domain, and then the Black Sea side being in the Ottoman domain. So that was absolutely crucial. And then, of course, the Russians, since about 1800, being the key colonial power. But as I alluded to earlier, this is a region where the local peoples have fiercely managed to maintain their autonomy. They've done it by striking alliances with great powers against their neighbours, but have always survived. I think a theme of this book would be that foreign interventions in this region generally fail, or even if they look as though they succeed, they only do by close cooperation with the locals. This is not a region where people have been assimilated by great powers, as you see actually over the border in Iran or Turkey, the way minorities have been pretty much absorbed in those two countries. The Russian Empire, in particular, didn't play by those rules and actually kept local identities alive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that this is an important thing to keep in mind, because there is a tendency to think that the local issues and the local power structures in those regions can be the tools of great power politics. And you can see this in the way the August War, 2008 August War, was dealt with, which of course we'll talk about too. But it's good to remind people that local conflicts, local identities do have a lot of say-so over the geopolitical issues, for sure. Let's talk... Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I would say that this is a very important theme, that the tail does tend to wag the dog in this region. And we talk about South Ossetia in 2008. I think that's a classic example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'll ask you to develop that more as we go on. Let's talk about Russian domination in particular. What impact did Imperial Russian rule have on the region throughout from the early 19th century until, say, 1917?
Well, an enormous impact, obviously, you see pictures of the Georgian monarchs in the 18th century wearing Persian dress, and in the 19th century, the Georgian nobility is looking to Europe via Russia, is dressing in a European manner, is learning French, is fighting with the Russian army against Napoleon. So particularly for the Armenians and Georgians, also to a less extent for these areas, the Russian Empire being a kind of a career ladder, as it were, upwards towards kind of Europe, towards some kind of more enlightenment values, towards modernity, obviously at a cost of, as with every colonial experience, of autonomy of local culture, obviously many examples of Russian imperial heavy-handedness, but certainly bringing this region in a rather weird way to Europe via the Russian Empire.
And one way, of course, is development of nationalism in the latter half of the 19th century. Talk a little bit about the development of Georgian, Armenian, and Azeri national identity from about 1860s to 1917.
Yes, obviously, this being part of an imperial structure which codifies people, which names people, which classifies people, solidified senses of identity of Georgians, Armenians, Azeris were called variously Tatars or still Turks. Their identity was more of a 20th century formation, early 20th century formation. But yes, clearly this did, as it were, solidify the national identities of these people, both within the empire and also in opposition to the empire. Again, I think we another classic colonial experience that the British experienced in India and other places that people who actually educated within the colonial system become some of the leaders in the rejection of it, and I think we saw this phenomenon in the Caucasus. And then obviously that the Caucasus were the Caucasians were quite active revolutionaries also at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century, such that when we fast forward to 1917, the Tsarist Empire pretty much gives up without a fight. That there's nothing, you don't have much to hang on to by 1917.
And how about the formation of national identity, say, between Armenians and Azeris? I mean, the relationship between ethnic groups themselves, how did that give way to a particular type of national identity?
Yes, I mean, I think that we can certainly see the roots of the conflicts, the protracted conflicts over Karabakh, Abkhazia, South Ossetia, in formation at the end of the 19th century with these national groups, all of whom looking for different patrons, looking for different national ideologies, and on a day-to-day level, and I think this is a constant theme of the Caucasus, people getting on absolutely fine, even intermarriage, a lot of trade, but a sort of political identity being defined against the other, which then turns into violence when the upper imperial order weakens, when the policeman, the Tsarist or Soviet policeman, goes off duty. And these neighbors confront one another and find that they don't trust each other, each other's policemen, and they end up in violence. So I think that is definitely, as you say, a phenomenon which begins at the end of the 19th century, and also this phenomenon, the Armenians increasingly looking to Russia as their protector, and the Azeris increasingly looking to Turkey.
And at the root of all of this too is, and this is a major moment in that period, is the Armenian genocide. Talk about its legacy. Well, talk about it, the genocide itself, and then its legacy for the region, up to the present.
Well, I mean, my book is a book about the Caucasus, and I wouldn't, many millions of words have been written on the Armenian genocide, and I wouldn't presume at all to be an expert. But obviously, I had to write about it, because it was obviously, the major catastrophe of the wider region, shall we say, within the last century. The breakup of the Ottoman Empire, a huge Armenian population in eastern Anatolia, as I mentioned, Armenian revolutionaries who are, in many cases backed by Russia or in many cases kind of self propelling revolutionaries, beginning to fight the Ottoman order, and therefore the Armenian minority in eastern Anatolia being caught in this vice, and being then subject to horrific deportation and murder in 1915, such that within a few years, maybe there was a couple of million Armenians, and suddenly a few years later there were none. This obviously is a huge trauma for the Armenian people. Most of the grandchildren of what is either you can either call Eastern Anatolia or Western Armenia are the Armenian diaspora, including in the United States. Many of them going to Eastern Armenia, which had been a bit of an outlying province, as it were, in the kind of great Armenian homeland, but then becomes, under Russian protection, the kind of the last locus of concentrated Armenian government and population. So then that, in turn, leads to Soviet Armenia being the sort of, as it were, the Israel, for want of a better phrase, for those Armenians. And then obviously in 1991 becoming an independent state. This in turn, I think, engenders this extraordinary vigilant Armenian siege mentality, which is very much the national ideology, which obviously affects their relationship with Azerbaijanis, who aren't Turks in many ways, and very different in many ways, but who Armenians actually call Turks. They don't have a separate word for Azeri.
1917, Russian Revolution, the Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan gain independence under their own nationalist revolutionaries, but over the next couple of years, the region is Sovietized. What role does Soviet rule play in transforming these nations?
Well, again, a huge transformation. I suppose one thing I would say at the outset in answer to that question is that Soviet rule is a many-layered and many-phased thing in the Caucasus. It starts off with the Bolsheviks conquering the region, in alliance with their local Bolshevik comrades, and promising basically to preserve the independence of these three briefly independent countries, Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Georgia. But then becomes a very different thing in the 1920s with centralization, obviously hyper-centralization. In the 1930s, they largely escape the Second World War, or at least the lands do, not the people who fought in the army. And then a very different experience in the post-war period. So many, many pluses and minuses. It's almost too many number. It's very hard to characterize. Obviously, as we know, a very authoritarian, repressive state killed millions of people, and yet also modernized, for better or for worse, and in many ways for better, this region in terms of infrastructure, literacy. There wasn't a single university in the Caucasus before the Soviet period, and obviously they left many behind. And also forming in this extraordinary way a stronger national identity in the Soviet period because of the division into union republics, which had their own institutions. And you could actually argue that Azerbaijan really is a 20th century formation, that it was the Soviet Union that kind of created, institutionalized, and defined Azerbaijan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the Soviet nationalities policy is this very contradictory thing, because on the one hand, they do want to, especially during the Stalin period, they want to suppress national independence. But on the other hand, they also create nations, create languages, create knowledge. They form, the canon for literature in this region. And this leads to something quite interesting after Stalin's death in 1953. You point to the fact that in the post-war period, there are two things that have happened. There is, on the one hand, a national revival. And then on the other, the Caucasus represents, as you call them, little empires. Tell us about the relationship between these two.
Yes, I think this is something we haven't really mentioned before. Is obviously, as well as the three big nationalities of this region, Georgians, Armenians, and Azerbaijanis, there are obviously these smaller ethnic groups. And I think the way the Soviet Union worked very much to the benefit of these bigger nationalities, Georgians, Armenians, Azeris, many of whom rose to very senior jobs in Moscow and senior jobs in the Soviet elite and won many privileges for their national culture in terms of academies of sciences and histories being written and so on, privileging of these three nationalities. But much more tricky situation for the sub-ethnic group, for want of a better phrase, people like Abkhaz, Ossetians, or this rather separate case of the Karabakh Armenians who were next door to Armenia but inside Azerbaijan, and not to mention even smaller groups like Kurds or Lezgins or Talish who were largely assimilated. So these smaller groups were deported under Stalin. They became the punished peoples, people like Kurds or Miskatian Turks. And then in the post-war period, they faced heavy assimilation and places like Abkhazia and South Ossetia facing a heavy kind of Georgianization within Soviet rule, which was very unpopular amongst those local populations.
So this national revival then amongst the Georgians and their efforts to assimilate those smaller peoples into its culture, and is this where your idea of them being little empires in and of themselves
The phrase actually isn't mine. The phrase is Andrei Sakharov's in an interview
right.
he gave in 1989. Obviously, you know, the Georgians have their own perspective that they also felt a bit precarious in relation to the Russians. So everyone has a, as it were, a big brother that they're a bit nervous of, and I think this in a sense is a, in a psychological sense, is a key to understanding the conflicts of the Caucasus. Everyone has someone they're afraid of, and it's a whole sort of a combination of different mutual insecurities between ethnic groups of different sizes.
Let's move on to those conflicts. If there is one ideology, and when you think of post-Soviet, the post-Soviet space, we think of a kind of loss of ideology. But if there is one ideology that unites, or at least post-Soviet Azerbaijan, Armenia, and Georgia share, it's nationalism. I mean, in a way, the nationalism of the past has come really to fruition in the post-Soviet period. How has the post-Soviet nationalism been a source for driving these frozen conflicts? And what is the relationship between nationalism and Armenia and Azerbaijan's conflict over Nagorno-Karabakh and Georgia's with Abkhazia and South Ossetia?
Well, certainly there is a sort of in the late 80s, early 90s, as whatever was left of socialist ideology collapses, nationalism definitely filled the vacuum. A rather sort of a nationalism born out of, in many ways, out of the rather the worst aspects of the Soviet educational system and those kind of national formations in of the Soviet period. A sort of regard, certainly Georgians talking about Ossetians and Abkhaz as guests, quote unquote, on their territory, very much this very intolerant attitude we also saw in the former Yugoslavia of, you know, why should I be a minority on your territory when you can be a minority on mine? And no democratic culture of negotiation or compromise on these issues. And, you know, obviously this was a phenomenon across the former Soviet space, but when it turned to conflict, the conflict, as it were, sort of, I don't know how to say this, the conflict kind of solidified the nationalism so that other people went through that phase in the 1990s, but the Caucasus is still stuck with it in the sense that it's become a part of the national identity in terms of part of the national ideology, in terms of the conflict we fought with the people we lost, the land we lost or the land we won. And so 20 years on, these regions are still stuck with that mobilizing national ideology as a powerful force. It's an instrument used by elites to legitimize themselves, but it's an instrument which also is a kind of trap for them in the sense that they have used that instrument against the other, but they can't move forward in the peace processes because they'll be accused of betrayal. And so even though people surely are a bit more tired and cynical about these national ideas than they were 20 years ago, we're still stuck with them, and we're still stuck with this kind of idea that our territory is a sacred thing which can't be compromised with the other.
Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, we have these very, you know, passionate and emotional local conflicts, but on the other hand, the Caucasus has been historically has been a great geopolitical concern because of oil. How has the geopolitics of oil impacted the region, particularly in the post-Soviet period?
Well, I'm a little bit skeptical about the role of oil when it comes to conflict. Certainly, obviously, oil and gas latterly has again put the Caucasus on the map, and obviously Azerbaijan on the map. Baku was, in fact, the world's first oil city back in the 1880s, and then slowly declined in the 20th century, and has picked up at more modest levels, but has made Azerbaijan an energy power again in the 1990s and the 2000s. And then we've had the building of two pipelines, the Baku-Jehan oil pipeline and the South Caucasus gas pipeline from Baku through Georgia to Turkey, which has definitely put the South Caucasus back on the map in terms of energy. And obviously this has cemented a relationship between Azerbaijan and Georgia. It's meant that Azerbaijan has been able to kind of create itself as a petro-state. I would argue that it's had surprisingly little influence on the conflicts. On the one hand, if you look at Azerbaijan, it means that Azerbaijan is more powerful and spends a lot more on its military. However, Azerbaijan has made no progress in recovering the land it lost in the 1990s to the Armenians in the Karabakh War. And also the presence of pipelines means that Azerbaijan has to be more worried about any new conflict, because obviously those pipelines would be vulnerable if fighting broke out.
Mm-hmm. And what about in terms of, say, other powers and their interest in the region, say Russia and the United States or Europe? How has these local powers become kind of a proxy war for larger issues, geopolitical issues?
Well, certainly the pipeline politics has contributed to run rather unhealthy polarization in the region between Azerbaijan, Georgia, Turkey on the one hand, as it were, looking to the United States in particular as a patron, and Armenia looking to Russia, Armenia also looking a bit to Iran. So there has been that polarization, which now that I live in Washington, I see some rather unhealthy symptoms of that in Washington, that there are some people in Washington who, for whom the Caucasus is basically all about oil and Azerbaijan, and the Armenians are an irritant to the development of the great relationship between Azerbaijan and the United States. So Russia obviously drawn in because Russia was suspicious of non-Russia pipeline routes, although I think Russia is now reconciled to that. I think that was very much, however, the game of the 1990s. I think we've seen some of the negative consequences of that, and hopefully people are trying to move a bit beyond that. And obviously, when we look at Armenia and Azerbaijan, each of them also have tried to balance their foreign policies. Armenia has, as it were, twin patrons in Moscow and in California, and Azerbaijan also tries to balance its foreign policy, and the Azeri elite is actually quite close to the Russian elite as well. It's Georgia which has made its kind of major ideological choice westwards for better or for worse.
Mm-hmm. 2003, Georgia is the site of the first so-called colored revolution. How has the Rose Revolution reshaped Georgian society and politics?
Well, it was obviously hugely important and radical event at the time. And it's still, in a sense, funny enough, even 8 years on, a bit of a work in progress. We don't know how that story ends. It starts with this great peaceful uprising against the because of the forged parliamentary elections in Georgia in 2003, ends up with Edward Shevardnadze resigning as president and this very young team coming to power, headed by Mikhail Saakashvili, the youngest head of state in Europe at the time. A series of quite radical reforms, particularly against corruption, in the first year, which really modernize a very weak state quite with surprising speed, although in a way that's not really fully democratic. It's an interesting and lively experiment, which we're now heading towards 2013, where Saakashvili has to step down. And I think we can only really judge this experiment by the way it ends. And certainly there have been many positive things about it. The cost, I suppose, has been Georgia's old pluralistic culture, which has been, as it were, taken over by this one very dynamic, young, pro-American, modernizing, but rather intolerant group, which is currently running Georgia.
Will Saakashvili leave office in 2013, or is he making steps to kind of secure his place?
Well, this is the great unknown, that the constitution has been changed in a way to strengthen the powers of the prime minister, so he could, in a constitutional fashion, do a Putin and become prime minister. However, he knows there would be a cost, big reputational cost, if he did that. So I think he's still weighing up his options. We don't really know the answer to that yet.
Georgia once again became international news when a war broke out in August 2008 between it, Russia, over South Ossetia. A lot has been in the press, especially about questioning who started the war. Was it Georgia? Was it Russia? Et cetera, et cetera. But why did the war start? Not who caused it, but why did it go hot?
Well, I one of my aims in writing this book was to give as balanced and nuanced picture as I could of how that war happened, and clearly it had local factors, and it was also driven, in a sense, by this very unhealthy kind of geopolitical rivalry between Russia and the United States in Georgia, over Georgia. So I think certainly the Russians were the ones who played their hands most cleverly. Georgia had lost Abkhazia and South Ossetia as de facto territories under its control in the 1990s. They were living in the kind of twilight zone. They looked to the Russians, but the Russia at that point didn't recognize them, but was slowly exerting its influence because the Georgians refused to deal with these territories. And Saakashvili's biggest and gravest mistake was rather than concentrating on domestic reforms, was to proclaim that he wanted to reintegrate Abkhazia and South Ossetia into Georgia by the end of his first term. These were long-term, protracted conflicts, and that was obviously alarming to the breakaway territories who saw this basically as a kind of bid for reconquest. And then basically from in summer of 2004, he had an aborted military campaign in South Ossetia. 2006, he took over a small mountainous bed of Abkhazia, which was under no one's control. We then really had an unhealthy dynamic coming after that time with Georgians pushing harder, the Abkhaz and Ossetians looking more and more to Russia, the Russians being happy to manipulate that situation. Overlaid with geopolitical issues such as in my mind, very unwise Washington initiative to try and get Georgia into NATO, which only antagonized the Russians. The issue about the recognition of Kosovo in February 2008 by the West, which the Russians saw as double standards. So Russia and Washington also beginning to kind of fight their disputes over Georgia. And Saakashvili, being not a cautious character but a gambler, rather than trying to see this as a problem, raising the stakes all the time and eventually, to my mind, going one step too far and another, under extreme pressure, of course, under extreme provocation, another bid on 7th of August 2008 to retake South Ossetia get one over the Russians, as it were, which ends in absolute catastrophe when immediately the Russians, who'd been waiting for something like this, respond with huge force. That, in a rather much too abbreviated nutshell, is kind of my version of what happened in 2008.
And what's the status of South Ossetia and Abkhazia now? Is there a real push for some kind of independent state, or will they be absorbed into Russia, or...?
They are proclaimed as independent states, although Abkhazia has a tiny population remaining of only about 30,000 people. So it's a tiny agricultural territory, which is not at all viable as an independent state. But Abkhazia more so, with about 200,000 people. But most importantly, after the war, end of August 2008, Russia recognizing both as independent states, so no longer recognizing them as part of Georgia. No other international power following up on that. So we have a kind of permanent truncation of the Caucasus with these would-be independent states, on the one hand supported by Russia, on the other hand Georgia fiercely resisting that. I believe that some kind of deal is possible over South Ossetia in the future, which really has no strategic interest to Russia. But even that will take quite a long time. Abkhazia, I think, it is a much, much more difficult nut to crack. We're looking at a kind of Cyprus analogy of, I think, many, many years before there will be any compromise over Abkhazia.
Mm-hmm. In your conclusion, you make a very interesting point. You say that, quote, more division and conflict can be avoided in the region if different parts of the South Caucasus start to think less like individual actors and more like members of a region. Why do you think that this would alleviate future divisions, or more division and more conflict? And what are the prospectus of this actually happening?
Well, to start with the perspective, so they're pretty bleak. But I think, having worked on this book, it's clear to me that the South Caucasus does make sense as a geographic and economic region, and in many ways a cultural region, and that it worked quite well as a region when there was an imperial master. Obviously, we don't want a new imperial master. We want any kind of integration to be voluntary. But it seems to me that any prospects it has in the future are as a communications hub between Europe and Asia, the North and South, East and West, and that these three countries are very small, and they need each other, and that also the kind of minority-majority conflicts will also be mitigated if there's some kind of supra-regional aspect to the way people manage their affairs in this region. This is obviously a very long-term perspective. Local politicians really aren't interested in it. But I think it's helpful for outsiders to try and think in these broader regional terms, particularly when they're planning kind of big trade and regional infrastructure projects.
Well, your book has certainly provided a good primer on the region. It certainly helps someone like me, who, of course, knows a bit about the Caucasus, but not too much. It's given me enough information to at least go on to future reading. So now that you're done with this book, what are you working on now? What's in store for you in the future?
Well, I'm currently with the Carnegie Endowment in Washington, which is a great opportunity just to pursue more Caucasus projects. I'm currently working on a project on Georgia, tackling that question that I raised earlier with Georgia. How is the Saakashvili administration going to handle the next couple of years? Is it going to institutionalize the reforms it made, or is it going to become just carry on being some kind of revolutionary cabal which doesn't put down deep roots? How serious are they about Europe? They've got a kind of strong Cato Institute libertarian wing, which is very skeptical of Europe, although in many ways Europe and the EU offers them an anchor, and particularly a kind of economic market that they shouldn't ignore. So looking at those kind of issues.
Well, thanks a lot for talking to us. I really appreciate it. And I look forward to hearing more from you.
Okay. Very good. Talk to you too.
We've been speaking with Thomas Duval about his book, The Caucasus, an Introduction. I hope you enjoyed the interview. Once again, I'm Sean Guillory, your host for New Books in Russian Eurasian Studies. If you're interested in hearing more interviews by the New Books Network, please go to newbooksnetwork.com. And be sure to tune in next week when New Books in Russian Eurasian Studies talks to Christopher Ward about his book, Brezhnev's Folly, The Building of BAM and Late Soviet Socialism. Until then, goodbye.
Оттого-то знать не весел дом, в котором мы живем, над лампочку повесить. Денег все не соберем.